This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Walmart sued by workers from another company. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. It is January 8th. We'll also get the latest from our woman on the scene at the Consumer Electronics Show. Find out why the government wants noisier cars. Get the latest on those censorship protests in China, and we'll find out why you can't necessarily just go off and make your own Batmobile.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Walmart today finds itself roped into a legal fight brought by warehouse workers. For the retailer, being the target of a class action suit is really nothing very novel. But what's unusual here is that these workers don't actually work for Walmart. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is here to explain a little more about the case. Hello, Mitchell.
Hi, Jeff.
So let's just start with the latest on the lawsuit and what has happened this week.
So a federal district court judge tentatively ruled yesterday that Walmart can be added as a defendant to a class action lawsuit. The lawsuit's brought by temporary warehouse workers. These workers move boxes exclusively for Walmart at a big warehouse in Southern California. Now, what's novel about this is that the workers don't actually work for Walmart directly. They're part of this big and growing reservoir of low-wage contract workers. We sometimes call them permatemps. The labor lawyers say this is the first time that Walmart has been brought into a case like this for its contracted workers.
So tell me more now about the allegations at this particular warehouse.
So this particular warehouse is operated for Walmart by a big national company called Schneider Logistics. The workers allege massive wage theft and other violations, things like failing to pay proper wages and overtime. The California Labor Department has already issued over $1 million in fines. Now, the key legal question is going to be, is it Walmart's fault? You know, does Walmart actually call the shots in these warehouses? Michael Rubin is a lawyer for the workers.
Walmart has the ultimate say in how the warehouse work will be conducted. The evidence shows a remarkable degree of control by Walmart. As a matter of economic reality, which is the ultimate legal test, Walmart should be held liable.
And what's the response so far from Walmart?
Walmart is definitely fighting getting dragged into this lawsuit as what is called a joint employer. That's the legalese for it. A Walmart spokesman emailed a statement to us this morning saying this case is a small part of a broader effort to change the warehousing industry, not just as it pertains to Walmart, but as a whole. Now, look, this lawsuit isn't a huge deal for Walmart financially if they lose, but they don't want to be held liable up the retail chain of command. That could be a serious kink in their famously efficient supply chain, which, of course, is also a key to their low prices.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Corporate earnings season is here yet again. The first of the big industrial bellwethers reports after the bell today. That would be Alcoa, the aluminum company. Here to talk market news on this Tuesday, as usual, we've got Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith, Moore & Company. She is with me from St. Louis. Hello, Julie.
Morning, Jeff.
When we were trading emails earlier this morning, you used a phrase. You said, we are in a stealth bull market. What do you mean by that?
Well, nobody feels like it. 2012, we did not have a single day below the comparable 2011 level. But this really has been going on since 2009, and we haven't had a single 10% correction since then. Nobody feels like it's a bull market, but it actually has been.
So the optimism that's reflected in the market indexes, do you share that?
Well, you know, it's really, you have to look behind it to see who's driving this market here. And it's almost a bull market by default. Institutional investors, not individuals, are participating. In fact, we're seeing net cash outflows from stocks and into bonds by individuals. They're even putting money in money markets, and that's where you're getting a princely 1/8% here. They're still smarting from the biggest plunge that we had in 2008 and 2009, and we've had in modern history here. But the fact is, it's not a trivial number of stocks and mutual funds that even now, 5 years later, are still not back to 2000 levels. But by default, there's no other place to put the money other than real estate and the stock market. And that's why institutional investors are in there, to earn at least something.
Individuals, though, are missing out, I guess.
Well, they are. It, you know, it's a situation of where they're so afraid and so fearful that they're acting against their own economic self-interest. This really is a market, though, where you don't play the total averages. You have to pick the right spots.
So earnings season kicks off today, as I said. Give us your preview, if you would.
Well, it's kind of lackluster. That's everybody's favorite description. And the usual whines, you've got a strong dollar, the weather, Hurricane Sandy, real cold weather really hasn't been around for the retailers. The government, always there, the fiscal cliff. And I'm waiting for retailers to really blame the flu season. That's usually the last-ditch explanation for poor performance. But fourth quarter accounting moves are really going to hit, too. If you aren't going to have a swell report, you dump everything conceivable in there and get it out of the way. So we're going to see a lot of write-offs and reserves. But there is some really good news out there. Oil is 8% lower than it was in 2011. Companies, for the most part, have really exhausted cost-cutting moves and stock buybacks. So what's left to boost earnings? It's going to be real growth, and there's not much there for the next few years. So this lackluster description is good.
Thank you. Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company.
You bet.
And let's do the numbers. Well, in the first few hours of trading today, it's been sort of a downward slide on Wall Street. The Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P at this hour, as I speak to you, down about 0.5%, each of them. We say earnings season kicks off later today with Alcoa, but one major company has gotten a jump on things this morning. One of Julie Neiman's hometown companies, in fact, Monsanto from St. Louis. They are known for dominating the market for genetically engineered seeds, corn and soybeans especially. The company outgrew analyst expectations in the latest quarter. Among other things, more farmers in Latin America are turning to Monsanto brand seeds. Keep an eye on Sears' share price today. The CEO has abruptly left, citing family health matters. In the meantime, the hedge fund king who owns the lion's share of the department store is stepping in to take over day-to-day operations. Here's one more little palate cleanser for you, I guess. Riddle me this, riddle me that. Who owns the rights to the big black bat? Time Warner and DC Comics, that's who. A court date is set later this month for an alleged rogue maker of full-scale Batmobiles. DC Comics says this fellow in Southern California is infringing copyrights by selling replicas and Batmobile conversion kits. The custom automaker, for his part, maintains his innocence. But the name of his business, I would think, probably will not help matters. It is called Gotham Garage. Well, speaking of stealthy cars, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration wants a new rule that would require some cars to make more noise. Specifically, these mostly silent electric and hybrid vehicles that are so common now. Here's Marketplace's Eve Troe.
Automobile magazine editor Jamie Kittman remembers test driving the very first Tesla, an electric sports car. He saw two guys about to cross the road in front of him.
I was thinking, God, these people are pretending they don't even hear me coming. And sure enough, right as I was about to run them over, they turned with a start and ran.
That problem's expected to grow as more electric cars hit the road. The new rule would require the companies that make those cars to add some kind of sound at low speeds, loud enough for bicyclists and pedestrians to hear. Kittman says the sound could be customizable.
There's no reason that your car couldn't sound like Rush Limbaugh or Rachel Maddow or Led Zeppelin.
Or.
You can't touch this.
Most likely, it'll sound like a traditional car engine. Michelle Krebs at Edmunds.com says automakers already add artificial mechanical sounds to lots of vehicles.
When you're driving a performance car, they can tune it to sound really guttural or throaty.
But most electric and hybrid car drivers like that their cars are quiet. So expect whatever sound they pick to be subtle. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Crowds of people gathered for the second time today outside the offices of a prominent newspaper in China. They're in an open revolt against government censorship of a publication that's called Southern Weekly. Earlier today, my colleague Jeremy Hobson talked with the BBC's Martin Patience, who's based in Beijing. Here's Jeremy.
Well, take us back to the beginning, Martin. How did this all begin?
Well, this all began about a week ago. Now, the Southern Weekly, which is a very influential newspaper in China, was publishing a New Year's message. Now, according to journalists on that newspaper, they say that their original New Year's message, which had called for political reform, was replaced by one praising the Communist Party. Now, why was there anger? Well, there was anger because the propaganda chief in that part of the country didn't consult the editors about these changes. So this is a protest against the level of censorship in China. They're not calling for complete freedom of expression, but they want to have more space in the media environment. The situation between the journalists, their editors, as well as the government has worsened. And then on Monday, a number of these journalists, up to 100 of them, went on strike.
As you have covered China, Martin, is there anything different about this case than other cases in which people sort of push back against the government?
Well, this is certainly a rare protest. I think what's significant about it is the timing. China has just installed a new generation of leaders. So in many ways, this represents their first political test, if you like. And I think certainly those pushing for greater freedoms of expression will be looking very carefully at how China's new leaders handle this case to get some sign of perhaps how they might govern over the next decade.
The BBC's Martin Patience joining us from Beijing. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And before we leave the world's most populous country, from a blog called China Smack, a quick story of a woman setting a good financial example for her kids. Yu Yuzhen is a mother of two. She is also a former vegetable farmer who became a millionaire landlord by steadily investing in local property. Even as she came into this great wealth, Yu has hung on to a job that she's had for the past 15 years as a city sanitation worker. 6 days a week, she sweeps the streets and washes trash cans in her reflective orange vest and her hat. She claims to love the job, but she also says that she intends to demonstrate a solid work ethic for her kids. I'd say that'll do it.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
The world's biggest electronics showcase is underway this week in Las Vegas, the Consumer Electronics Show, or CES. Our technology reporter, Marketplace's Queenie Kim, is on site chatting up the exhibitors and scoping out the latest trends. And she is beaming in to be with me now. Hello, Queenie.
Hey.
So let's talk TV. I gather you are surrounded by screens out there, and what's the latest on that front?
Well, you've heard of HD TV?
Uh-huh.
Well, you'll be hearing a lot more of 4K TV, which is an even higher definition TV.
Sounds nifty. Why do we need that?
Well, it's all about size. TVs are getting bigger and bigger, and not too long ago, you know, the 46-inch TV was considered the big screen. Well, Samsung had one on a display yesterday that was 85 inches, and that's 7 feet, and they're going to even go up to 110. So the problem becomes, how do you keep that screen sharp? And that's where 4K comes in. Joe Stinziano is an executive vice president in Samsung, and he explains.
As TVs get bigger and bigger, the screens and the pixels, the distance between those pixels starts to grow, and the picture quality can start to deteriorate. So it's time for a new high level of resolution, and this is the new industry standard of ultra-high definition.
So be our eyes here, Queenie. How did it look?
Well, I was standing like a good 20 feet from the stage where they had this thing on display, and it looked like a sharp photo. It was clear, it was sharp. But the problem is that not a lot of TV networks are using 4K cameras yet, and this is the same problem HD TV ran into. It came out before the network switched over to HD cameras. So you won't truly be able to see the full glory of 4K, even if you buy one of these bad boys, you know, at the end of the year.
If we do buy one of these bad boys, as you said, what's it going to cost us?
Well, I thought that 4K stood for $4,000, but apparently it's going to cost a lot more than that. The 85-inch is coming out sometime this year, Samsung says, but the company is staying mum about the price.
So you're wandering around in this tech wonderland for a few days. Just give me something else quickly that, I don't know, something that's blown your mind.
Well, I don't know if it's blown my mind, but, you know, another big theme is connectivity. And Sony last night had a press preview where they're showing off how all their devices connect. So now they're making phones. And, of course, we know that they make TVs and a bunch of other kind of electronics. And so now they've got this technology where you can take the Sony phone and tap the Sony headset and transfer your music there. Or tap the Sony remote control for the TV and transfer the movie you're watching on your phone to the TV. And it's all seamless.
And all about tapping, evidently. Thanks a lot, Marketplace's technology reporter, Queena Kim.
Thank you.
This week, the Television Critics Association Winter Press Tour is going on. It's supposed to woo TV critics, who then drive audiences to tune in. Advertisers get in on the game and, people make money. But almost half of American homes now have a DVR, so viewers can watch shows later and breeze through commercials if they want to. That has upset the model that has reigned for decades. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, advertisers are coming around to the concept.
Take the ABC comedy Modern Family. If you record and watch it on a DVR like TiVo, the network can still get credit with advertisers. Stacey Lynn Schulman is chief research officer with TVB, a trade organization representing local TV stations.
If you view that through a DVR recording within 3 days of the day that it aired live, you are counted in that audience as long as you watched one commercial within that show.
Viewers do skip commercials, but only about half the time. Mitch Oscar is a media consultant with Hocus Focus. He says people catch glimpses of commercials as they fast forward.
When they caught frames of commercials, they might say, yeah, I'm really interested in that movie, and they would rewind and watch it.
Oscar says advertisers would prefer it if viewers would switch from DVRs to video on demand. That service often disables the fast-forward function, so you're stuck watching the commercials. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And just wrapping things up for this Tuesday, you may be familiar with the debate over corporate personhood, if you've heard that term before. Since 1819, more or less, the Supreme Court has held that corporations are people in many critical legal contexts. That's had big implications for campaign finance, among other things. Well, an activist in California has made a creative bid to try to challenge that long-held precedent. Jonathan Freeman founded a corporation of some sort. I don't really know exactly what it is, but I don't think it matters. He founded a corporation and then loaded a bunch of documents related to the corporation into his car. So then he went cruising in the carpool lane, where he was, of course, pulled over for driving alone. Ah, not so, says Freeman. My corporation is a person, and it was in the car with me. Freeman's Marin County court fight over his $500 ticket begins this week. Next stop, Washington. Or not. That is today's Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.